What's my subscription to the New York Times have me doing this week? Preparing a strawberry pretzel pie. Solving spelling bee with no hints. Planning a trip to one of the 52 best places to go. Getting to the bottom of the big pants trend.
Whoa.
And I'm finally replacing my vacuum with a recommendation I can trust. What will your subscription to the Times have you do? Why not find out? With our best offer, go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, day two of Judge Neil Gorsuch's Supreme Court confirmation hearings. Senators question, who does Gorsuch work for? The president, corporations, or regular Americans? And as Democrats attack Gorsuch as an enemy of regular Americans, a case that he says proves they're wrong. It's Wednesday, March 22nd.
So let's start with my first question. I'd like to have you describe in any way you want to what judicial independence means, and specifically tell us whether you'd have any trouble ruling against a president who appointed you.
That's a softball, Mr. Chairman.
Turn your microphone on.
I'm sorry. So that's a softball, Mr. Chairman. I have no difficulty ruling against or for any party other than based on what the law and the facts in the particular case require.
From the very beginning of his confirmation hearing on Tuesday morning, Judge Neil Gorsuch was fielding questions about independence, questions from the left and from the right, starting with independence from the man who nominated him.
I really want to congratulate the president to pick you. Quite frankly, I was worried about who he'd pick. Maybe somebody on TV.
For Democrats, the question of independence went further. Judge Gorsuch would replace the late conservative Justice Antonin Scalia. Scalia was known to vote for businesses when their interests clashed with those of their workers.
Give you a short list. Ledbetter versus Goodyear Tire, which limited the ability of women to seek equal pay. Gross v. FBL Financial Services, which made it more difficult to prove age discrimination. University of Southwest Texas.
Senator Dianne Feinstein began with what would be a focus of Democrats all day, independence from corporate interests.
Each of these cases was 5-4, and Justice Scalia voted with the majority against the employee in every case. President Trump and others have said, you are the next Scalia. How do we have confidence in you that you won't just be for the big corporations?
Adam, what was Senator Feinstein getting at with that question?
There are a bunch of cases that liberal groups have identified in which Judge Gorsuch ruled in favor of business interests and against the little guy.
Adam Liptak covers the Supreme Court for The Times.
And Senator Feinstein's question was, you know, please convince me that you're not this hard-hearted, cold formalist, but someone who has some sense of human decency. And Judge Gorsuch actually gave a fairly polished answer, pointing to lots and lots of decisions. He says he's participated in 2,700 of them.
And if you want cases where I've ruled for the little guy as well as the big guy, there are plenty of them, Senator. Orr versus City of Albuquerque, WD Sports, Casey, Energy West, Crane, Simpson versus CU involving young women who had been harassed by the football team, the Rocky Flats case, which vindicated the rights of people who had been subject to pollution by large companies in Colorado, uranium pollution, pregnancy discrimination in the police department in Albuquerque.
Often he said in favor of the little guys.
Colorado's effort with renewable energy upheld that.
Sometimes in favor of the big guy, but always, he said, as the law compelled him to do. And that was characteristic of a very smooth performance over many hours of questioning from 20 different members of the Judiciary Committee.
And Senator, the bottom line, I think, is that I'd like to convey to you from the bottom of my heart is that I'm a fair judge.
What's an example of the kind of case that Feinstein was referring to when she asked that really pointed set of questions?
Well, the case everyone is focused on all day long has come to be known as the frozen trucker case.
In January of 2009, I was working as a commercial truck driver for Trans Am Trucking Incorporated. I was hauling a load of meat through the state of Illinois.
Poor guy, brakes froze, stranded on the side of a highway.
I expected that help would arrive within an hour.
And is ordered by his company to stay there with his truck.
I awoke 3 hours later to discover that I could not feel my feet. My skin was burning and cracking, and I was having trouble breathing.
He finally is so numb and freezing that he decides to unhitch the truck from the trailer.
I started having thoughts that I was going to die.
And go off to seek help.
Wow.
My employer fired me for disobeying their orders.
He's fired. He sues.
7 different judges heard my case. One of those judges found against me. That judge was Neil Gorsuch.
And the question in the case is one just of what the federal law in question means. It says you can't be fired for refusing to operate your vehicle or equipment or whatever. And on this one, Judge Gorsuch said he was a literalist. He didn't refuse to operate. He did operate. He took off and went for help.
Is that a distinctly conservative approach to dealing with corporations and workers?
Not uniformly, but probably a preponderance of conservative judges use this approach in interpreting statutes to look at the plain words of the statute in front of them and not take into account purpose and consequences in legislative history, but just say, what do these words mean?
The plain meaning rule would create an absurd result. It is absurd to say this company is in its rights to fire him because he made the choice of possibly dying from freezing to death. That's absurd. It makes me question your judgment.
It's certainly a mode of interpretation that Justice Scalia adopted, and Judge Gorsuch in this regard follows in those footsteps.
Okay, let's talk about Roe v. Wade. What is the holding of Roe v. Wade in 30 seconds?
Well, the holding of Roe versus Wade in 30 seconds, Senator, is that a woman has a right to an abortion.
When it comes to the Supreme Court, abortion is the thing that gets the most intense and emotional on both sides. What was Senator Graham up to here with that question?
Well, there were sort of set-up questions from Graham and other Republicans in which they knew what answer they were going to get.
Had you ever met President Trump personally?
Not until my interview.
In that interview, did he ever ask you to overrule Roe v. Wade?
No, Senator.
What would he have done if he'd asked?
Senator, I would have walked out the door. It's not what judges do.
Okay.
They don't do it at that end of Pennsylvania Avenue, and they shouldn't do it at this end either, respectfully.
He said exactly the same thing John Roberts said, which is that it's a settled precedent, that it's entitled to respect, but that even Supreme Court precedents sometimes must be overturned if they were wrongly decided and overcome other barriers to overturning precedents. So what we knew about Judge Gorsuch yesterday is no different than what we know about him today about abortion.
Gorsuch seems to have a real gift for disarming his interrogators in the Senate. And I was struck by a really tough line of questioning from Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont.
You said judges should, I quote you, strive to apply the law as it is, focusing backward, not forward.
He started asking really tough questions about corporate money and elections.
Do you believe that James Madison and the other drafters of the First Amendment understood the term speech to include corporate money being funneled into campaigns?
And when it was Gorsuch's turn to answer,
I don't remember that term, no, Senator.
Trust me. There wasn't.
I trust you.
Okay.
Entirely.
You don't have to.
Not that much?
He engaged in this very playful back and forth with Leahy.
I'll let it go.
What did you take from that?
I thought particularly early in the day, he got tired as the day went on, but early in the day, he had a very nice, folksy, disarming, self-deprecating demeanor.
And if I start saying I like one opinion or I like the other opinion,
all right,
I'm signaling,
I'll let you off the hook.
Oh.
Let me go to another one.
Thank you, Senator.
So I don't think any of these senators have a problem with the man personally. He's a very appealing individual. They may well have a problem with how he's going to vote.
Judges would make very poor legislators. We're not equipped for it. We're not responsive to the people. Can't elect us, can't get rid of us. You're stuck with us.
So, Adam, one of my favorite moments, and I was going to tee this up.
I'm permitted four law clerks for 1 year at a time, right out of law school.
You guys are the ones who should make law. I've got these evanescent, you know, four-year clerks. Trust me, I'm not the kind of guy you want making law. He turned it, like, into this very self-effacing thing.
If you were to make laws, I don't think you'd design a system where you'd let three older people with four young law clerks straight out of law school legislate for a country of 320 million. That's just not how anyone would design the railroad.
Do you remember that?
I do, and that sort of approach plays well with Congress, of course. Congress is sometimes unhappy when the court strikes down decisions that they've made.
With all respect to my law clerks, I love them very much. They're like family. But they're not the same as your staffs and the investigative powers you have.
He did something similar in talking about dark money and Citizens United, and he was asked whether he would urge his supporters, who have poured some considerable number of millions of dollars, to support the effort to get him on the court, whether he would urge his supporters to disclose themselves, to come out of the shadows. And he said, no, that would be a political move. But you know what, Senator? You guys are free to do that. Supreme Court hasn't stopped you from passing disclosure laws. If you want disclosure, you should have disclosure. You're the king here.
Adam, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here, Michael.
Neil Gorsuch will continue his testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee today. We'll be right back.
My name is Jasmine Ulloa, and I'm a national politics reporter for The New York Times. I grew up in Texas, on the border with Mexico, and I've been reporting in the region since I was in high school. Now I travel the country looking for stories and voices that really capture what immigration and the nation's demographic changes mean for people. What I keep encountering is that voters don't fall into neat ideological boxes on this very volatile issue. There's a lot of gray. And that's where I feel the most interesting stories are. I'm trying to bring that complexity and nuance to our audience, especially in such a critical election year. And that's really what all of my colleagues on the politics team and every journalist at the New York Times is aiming to do. Our mission is to help you understand the world, no matter how complicated it might be. If you want to support this mission, consider subscribing to the New York Times. You can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
I'm just going to say hi to Cynthia. Should I say Ms. Orr? Cynthia, let's be human.
Non-Bad Drugs, this is Liz. How can I help you?
Hey, I'm trying to reach Cynthia. It's Michael Barbaro from the New York Times.
Yes, let me get her for you. Just a second, okay?
Thanks.
Thank you for choosing Non-Bad Drugs.
In defending himself against the accusation from Democrats that he favors employers over their workers, one of the cases that Neil Gorsuch mentioned was Cynthia Orr versus the city of Albuquerque.
This is Cindy. How can I help you?
Hey, Cindy, it's Michael Barbaro from the New York Times. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Am I catching you at work?
I am at work, but it's okay. I talked with the pharmacy owner and kind of told him what was going on, and he was like, take all the time you need.
Oh, that's really wonderful. Well, please tell him thank you, and I'm really grateful that you're able to take some time to talk to us. I want to start by kind of giving listeners an understanding of where you were and kind of, you know, what your life was like back in 1999. So I'm just going to kind of ask you to talk me through that for just a little bit.
So in 1999, I was pregnant with my first child. My husband and I were both detectives with the Albuquerque Police Department. And, you know, it took us 2 years to get pregnant. So it was an important pregnancy for us as a family.
Mm-hmm.
When we had our baby, of course, I called my supervisor and let him know that it was a cesarean section, but everything was fine. Baby was healthy. We were fine. And that I was going to start my leave. And when I asked my immediate supervisors, they were great. They were wonderful. They were like, sure, Cindy, let us know how much time you need.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until after I submitted my paperwork that things got a little crazy, because it was the human resource manager who changed my paperwork and decided that I couldn't use compensatory leave that I had to use sick leave. And interestingly enough, as I told you, my husband was a police officer as well. He took compensatory time and they didn't do anything to him.
So he was given that leave that you wanted.
Yes. Now, our last name is Orr. We're the only Orrs on the police department.
Right.
His went through and mine got flagged.
Why do you think you were being treated differently than your husband?
I truly believe it was because I was a female police officer and I was pregnant. And the discrimination was directly related to me being a pregnant female on the department.
So at that point, you did what?
Well, at that point, we consulted an attorney, myself and another police officer who had her baby in close proximity to mine and who went through the same scenario I did. And we filed a lawsuit that went on for years. It was exhausting. It was tiring. It was just unbelievable.
Eventually, your case reaches the appeals court where Judge Gorsuch sits, and he rules in your favor. He wrote, quote, "The police department's treatment of you and your fellow pregnant officers was not a random accident, but part of a larger and deliberate pattern of treating pregnant women differently from other employees." What do you make of that?
I was grateful that finally somebody listened and that somebody saw what we saw. And now somebody with some authority is holding you accountable.
Did you think that the courts would give you a fair shot on this?
You know what? I didn't. After so many years, I almost just, you know, threw my hands up and said, you know, this is a man's world in a man's police department, and, you know, I just need to finish up my career until we got that ruling from Judge Gorsuch. It was like a breath of fresh air. It was like somebody gets it. It was like somebody sees it. I'm not making this up.
The Gorsuch ruling came very late in the process. What would have happened to your case if Judge Gorsuch and the court he was on hadn't ruled this way?
You know, I think it would have come to the point where I couldn't continue to fight it. You know, you feel like you were taking advantage of and there was nothing you could do and nobody was going to listen. And fighting a government entity is difficult at best.
So now this judge, Neil Gorsuch, is President Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court. Did you make that connection?
You know, I didn't. I remember seeing the nomination and I reviewed his credentials without making the connection that he was the one that ruled in our case. And it wasn't until this morning that it dawned on me that he was the judge that ruled in our case.
Well, it's interesting. Judge Gorsuch brought up your case on Tuesday after being questioned by a Democratic senator about whether he was capable of looking out for the little guy, whether he was a judge who cared about the kind of regular working person in this country. I wonder what you would say to that.
I would say he absolutely is. You know, I feel like I got stepped on and pushed aside and basically ignored for years until he reviewed our case and said, no, this one person, this individual in this case was wronged.
Well, Cindy, I'm grateful for your time. Thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you.
Here's what else you need to know today. President Trump spent the day on Capitol Hill demanding that House Republicans fall in line. He told them to support the plan to replace the Affordable Care Act when they vote on Thursday or risk losing their reelection.
We're going to have a real winner. It was a great meeting. They're terrific people. They want a tremendous health care plan. That's what we have, and there are going to be adjustments for it. But I think we'll get the vote on Thursday.
And the Times found that enacting that plan would result in more people being uninsured than just repealing the Affordable Care Act. I called my colleague Margot Sanger-Katz, who studied the numbers.
Yeah, it was actually pretty surprising to me. If you sort of think it through, it makes sense a little bit because this bill is making some changes to Obamacare but leaving other parts in place. And it turns out that combination of policies actually leads to a situation where a lot of people lose their health insurance more, in fact, than if you just went back to the way things were before Obamacare.
Finally, the United States is barring airline passengers from 8 foreign airports, including Cairo, Istanbul, and Dubai, from boarding flights with electronics larger than a cell phone. U.S. intelligence officials tell The Times that terrorist groups like the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda are trying to smuggle explosives hidden in devices like laptops. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.